నామ శ్రేష్టమనమీ సచ్చిపుత్రస్వరూపం రూపం తస్యాగ్రజామరుపురి మాతృం గౌస్తవాతిం రాధాకుందం గిరివరమహో రాధికామారవాసాం ప్రాప్తో జస్య ప్రతీతకృపయా శ్రీగురుం తన్మతోస్మి. హరే కృష్ణ. Some question, Prabhu?
Yes, Maharaj. Yeah. Last week we celebrated two festivals, the appearance day of Bhaktivinoda Thakur and disappearance day of Haridas Thakur, respectively. And two questions remain unasked. One from Sulakshanadidi, referring to Bhaktivinoda Thakur, and one from Priyanana, referring to Haridas Thakur. Mm-hmm. So, first question from Sulakshana. She's asking...
One thing I wanted to say about... I forgot to say about Srila Haridas Thakur was that when he was tested by Maya Devi, it said that she was exhibiting feminine postures and that would bewilder the mind of Brahma. So in this, sometimes the case may be that it's Brahma Haridas. So as Brahma, Karma Misra Brahma, he could be bewildered by Maya. But here, as Haridas Thakur in Gaur Leela, Maya has no such effect upon him. So it's an interesting sidebar or observation. But what is the question?
So Sulakshana is asking how Bhaktivinoda Thakur got his title Satchitananda. Is there any story behind that?
I'm sure there is, but it doesn't come to mind.
Then question from Priyanana Didi. Yeah. In Puri, Mahaprabhu provided Haridas Thakur with everything necessary, place to stay and prasadam to take, so he could chant without any problems. And he visited Haridas Thakur himself daily.
Yeah.
Why does the Lord feel happy when devotees chant his name?
Well, the first thing that comes to my mind is in the Gaudiya Math 1, person came to the devotees complaining that his brother was always taking the name Radhe, like we hear people do, to the point of casual meaninglessness, which is very unfortunate. But in this case, in a mildly humorous way, Guru said, that man was asking a very simple-hearted person, saying, won't she be disturbed? like someone's always taking your name. Won't she be disturbed by that? But sometimes people think, it seems this question alludes to something that people think all the time, like as if Krishna, he's seeking approval in the form of worship. And not in her question, but other times people say, you know, what sort of ego would someone have that they need to be worshipped? So it is, what is this question again?
Why does the Lord feel happy when devotees chant his?
So, it depends on how we define taking the name. So there's neophytes taking the name, intermediate level devotees taking the name, Mahabhagavatas taking the name. I remember hearing how symptomatic of the Mahabhagavata was that when you see him, you take the name of Krishna. And I remember seeing Srila Prabhupada in his room in New York. He had just arrived at the New York temple, and he went into his quarters, and I had some service to do there. And I remember when I encountered him, that I became filled with Krishna Nam. And we should say, it means, what it's alluding to is a particular quality of Krishna Nam. As Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Gurmar says, that he says in one place that when Mayavadis take the name of Krishna, as they sometimes do, he said, it is like hurling thunderbolts at the holy body of Krishna. So then we can say, well, it is not merely the sound of Krishna's name, these syllables that are joy-inducing, joy-producing. So Srila Guru Maharaj, he often refers to the Prema Vibhart of Jagadananda Pandit. He says, Namakar Bahiroi Bhatanamakar Unoi. Namakar means the literal syllable, like Krishna. Namakar Bahiroi Bhatanam. So the external aspects of the sound, it says, Kabunoi is saying, it's never that. It doesn't say, well, sometimes it is, sometimes it is. It says, it's never that. So it's never the external aspect. But the internal aspect with which the name is being taken. Even in this world, people are sensitive about this. How someone says their name. And again, this points all the subtleties we have of human culture and human interaction. To deny that prospect or possibility to divinity, why? It's so insulting, actually, as Mahaprabhu tells in Chaitanya Bhagavat when he's in the Varaha Bhav at the house of Murari Gupta. There's a sannyasi in Varanasi, referring to Prakasananda Saraswati Thakur, saying, you know, he's maiming my divine form in his denial, the, you know, cannot see, cannot hear, cannot taste, cannot feel. Like denuding, blind, deaf, dumb, the supreme reality. Still, people, they are sensitive to how their name is being taken. Because they can tell when it's being taken mindlessly, angrily, lovingly, and other leaves. So, what to speak of Krishna? So, Srila Guru Maharaj, he once referred to this as voltage. Right? Like we have different types of voltage. I saw something today, it said 5 volts output. and not so much. But then sometimes we see a sign that has like lightning bolts, and it's usually in red. And what does it say? High voltage. You know, caution. And in that case, only someone who's super qualified can handle that. So once Srila Guru Maharaj referencing the, you know, what sort of voltage is in the Krishna Nam of Yashoda? I remember when I was a child in the neighborhood I lived in, all the children are out playing, and when it's around dinner time, the mothers would go usually to the back door, and they cry out the name of their child and announce that it's dinner time. Right? And then they're in the midst of their play, they hear their mother's voice and calling, and then they go home for dinner. So when Yashoda calls the name of Krishna, what is the voltage of the love and devotion infused in that Krishna Nam? That's inconceivable to us. But we can understand that such a plane exists. Or when Srimati Radharani takes the name of Krishna, when she's calling Krishna, what sort of voltage is in the Krishna Nam of Srimati Radharani? How much the magnitude of love and affection in that Krishna Nam? How can Krishna not be happy? Supremely happy by being addressed by his beloved and his mother and all of his devotees who take his name with love and affection. Heart-meltingly happy. The power of Krishna Nam is so great. Recently we celebrated the Rath Yatra, and we know in these Puri pastimes especially toward the end, as we mentioned, during the day Mahaprabhu is trying to keep his composure and not become overwhelmed by ecstatic sentiments, ecstatic transformations. So he keeps a distance from the deity, from the Guru to Stundam, he's taking darshan. Because we know upon his arrival, when he first came, he's rushing toward Jagannath, he's fainting. Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya is observing the Asta Sattvika Vikar, eight different types of ecstatic symptoms, and their most blazing stage of manifestation. So Mahaprabhu, by there's some way that he's trying to check his divine sentiments, particularly during the day and in public. Whereas in the evening, it is more unrestrained. And particularly in the last 12 years of his manifest pastimes. And we're told, although the Gangbir, his room, it has no windows, but three doors, and the three doors are barred. Right? They're shuttered. What is that? Dirgar Argala, that bar. And there's a devotee outside, and what do they hear? But Mahaprabhu taking Krishna Nam, what we're told sometimes rubs, what he's experiencing is so intense, and his longing for Krishna and his separation from Krishna, rubbing his lotus face into the wall till bleeding, bouncing off the walls. But and they're hearing pitiful, pathetic wailing, love and separation from Krishna. But as painful as that is, still it indicates that he's in the room. So somehow they have to tolerate that. But sometimes they don't hear anything. And if for a long, long time they don't hear anything, they get Swarup Damodar. And then Swarup Damodar comes and opens the door to see, to check on Mahaprabhu. And sometimes, although there are no windows and there are these three doors that are shut, Mahaprabhu cannot be found. By his inconceivable potency, he leaves that room, being pulled by the force, the power, union and separation. And we hear sometimes he's going to the Chatak Parbat, seeing a sand dune, he's taking it to be Govardhan. This is that divine vision. Everywhere he casts his glance, his vision, is a reminder of Krishna. Told the vision of separation is most spacious. Whereas in the presence of Krishna, in union, the focus is exclusive. Right? Seeing Krishna and everything else is blurred, like in the portraiture, in photography. You focus on the subject and everything else is blurred. Right? But in viraha, in separation, an inversion takes place. And again, like in photography, what they call infinite depth of field, or the depth of field of infinity, everything is a reminder of Krishna. So, like we hear, Brahm, Pramad, Viparlipsha, Karna, Patava. Brahm, these are the four defects of a conditioned soul. But in the case of Mahaprabhu, his Brahm, his mistake, is he's mistaking a sand dune for Govardhan Hill. He's mistaking the ocean for Jamuna. And so he's running into the Jamuna. Sometimes they find him there after hours and hours. He's floating in the Jamuna for hours in a near death-like trance. And if for a moment we can conceive of how much love and affection these devotees have for Mahaprabhu, so to be constantly placed in situations where they think he may have left the world is heartbreaking for them, and keeping them in a constant state of anxiety about the welfare of Mahaprabhu. So Swarup Damodar will lead a torch-lit party, and they go searching, sometimes finding Mahaprabhu at the Shingadwar, the eastern gate of the Jagannath temple. And like Jagannath, when the ecstasy of separation goes in a particular direction, all the limbs of his body enter like a tortoise. And sometimes they will find Mahaprabhu in this way. He looks like a golden pumpkin. All the limbs have gone, his head, limbs, they've all gone inside his body. It's so intense. The ecstasy that he is experiencing, and he's still golden. Then he gradually comes out of that state and resumes his divine form. Other times, the ecstasy going in another direction, and all of his joints becoming separated by this much. And the devotees find him. This always is devastating for the devotees to see him this way. It is not a pretty sight. But then his body resumes its normal position. But other times they find him in the ocean. And we're told on one such evening that he was found by a fisherman. And we've seen also in Puri the fishermen, they fish at night in their boats. And so in his net, he's pulling the net in, and there's Mahaprabhu in his net. And when he has a little light or something on his boat, then he touched the body of Mahaprabhu, and he became infused with Krishna Nam. But he was frightened and went to the shore, took his net, boat net to the shore. Now Mahaprabhu's in the net on the shore in a death-like trance, and that man thinks that he's now ghostly haunted because he's incessantly taking Krishna Nam. And he's running away. And then comes Srup Damodar with his torch and leading the group of devotees. And they see this man. He's saying, "Don't go that way. There's a ghost there. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna." And they say, "What is this ghost?" And they say, "Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna." And Srup Damodar tells him, he said, "I am an exorcist. And Oja, I am an exorcist, and I know what to do in this. Please take me there." And the man takes him, and they find Mahaprabhu wrapped in a fisherman's net, his divine form. He's in this near-death-like trance. And the devotees are crying and wailing, and they surround Mahaprabhu, and they're just going, "Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare." They're taking Krishna Nam, and we're told Mahaprabhu has three states: his internal state, half internal and half external, and external. And by external, we don't mean external consciousness. It's just a convenient way of understanding these three divine states of his. As we told, when he's aware of the external world, he's trying to maintain his composure and constrain his ecstatic position. So he's in the deep internal state, but they're taking Krishna Nam and it's pulling him. And then we're told gradually Mahaprabhu is half internal, half external. And then as he's moving more towards external, he starts to cry and lament. And he's saying, "I was so happy there. I was in Vrindavan, in Radha Kunda. And Radha and Krishna and the Braja Gopis were playing there. And I had some seva on the shore." He said, "It was so beautiful. It was the most beautiful thing I've ever seen or heard. And even the sounds of their ornaments and their divine play, that sound was the most beautiful sound I've ever heard. And then you, all of you made some noise and broke my happy dream." And then he's crying and lamenting. So Srila Guru Maharaj, he pointed out, what is that noise? That noise is the Krishna Nam of all of these Shuddha Bhaktas. Right? They're not chanting Namabhas nor Namaparad. They're Shuddha Bhaktas. They're taking Shuddha Nam. And Srup Damodar is there as one of them. So when we talk about voltage. So this is high voltage Krishna Nam. And Mahaprabhu was saying, compared to the sound of the ornaments of Radha and Krishna and Brajagopis and their divine pastimes, you made some noise and disturbed and brought me, and my happy dream broke, and now I'm here lamenting. Right. But then Srila Guru Maharaj, he gave entirely opposite interpretation. And that's one way you can see. He said, but another thing that can be seen, extracted by his divine grace, he said, what this pastime demonstrates is the power of Krishna Nam is such, it's so great that it was given preference over direct participation in Leela. So he's directly participating in Leela, and the Krishna Nam brought him, had a pull upon him from there. So how powerful is Krishna Nam? How riveting is Krishna Nam? But particularly according to the magnitude and intensity, as Guru Maharaj told, the voltage of the love and devotion with which Krishna's name is taken. Any other question? And whatever we may think, Sri Rupa, Srila Rupa Goswami, when we're mentioning Haridas Tagore, the Namacharya. And in the presence of Haridas Thakur and all these other senior super servitors, when Mahaprabhu is more or less introducing Rupa Goswami to them within Gaura Lila. Because we say, well, don't they all know each other? Guru Maharaj said it's like hide and seek. All who have their positions, as we know from Kavi Karnapur and Gono Desha Deepika, descend from Krishna Leela, and one by one they're being discovered in Gaura Leela according to their, how to recognize them, according to their devotional qualities. because the divine form, the Swarup, is based upon dedicating tendencies, units and units and units of dedicating tendencies. Right? That's, you know, the molecular structure of the Swarup. So, and indicating Rupa Goswami as the qualified person to continue his line. So he's asking Rupa Goswami to recite various slokas that he's composed. And then, for one, he says, tell us that sloka upon hearing which everyone becomes happy. And it's about Krishna Nam. Now we go in the other direction. Namakar Bahiroi Vatanama Kabunoi Jagadananda Pandati. It's not the syllables. It's the current of devotion with which the holy name is taken that brings illumination. So here, you know, Krishneti Varna Dvayi, and Rupa Goswami's play, his drama, one devotee is saying to another, I do not know how much nectar there are in the two syllables, Krish and Na. Tunde tandavini vitim ritanute tundavali labdiye karna kroda kadambini gatayate karnar budhevya spriha. When I take the name of Krishna, it's so sweet and relishable that one tongue is insufficient to taste all of that divine substance. My heart expresses that it wants millions of tongues to relish that sweetness. And the sound of Krishna Nam is so sweet and enchanting to the ear that two ears are insufficient to capture that nectarine sound. I wish I had millions of ears to capture all of that nectar. So this should give us some perspective. From one point of view, we might think, this is poetry, and poetry makes use of hyperbole and exaggeration and other such things. But this is not, this is coming from Srila Rupa Goswami. The better way to interpret this is for us to understand that this indicates there is such a plane where this is a heartfelt expression and aspiration, where it's real and meaningful, substantial, and not hyperbolic. And necessarily it must be so if, in fact, we're dealing with the infinite. Right? How can the finite capture the infinite or the whole of the infinite? So it's very beautiful. And Mahaprabhu, when he told, tell this sloka that makes everyone happy, all the devotees started to cheer, and Haridas Thakur is there. And think about it, he's the Namacharya. And all these great devotees assembled together, they know all the scriptures, they know all the verses about Krishna Nam. And they're all in agreement that we've never heard something quite like this. This is the best. You've made everyone super happy with this expression. Yes.
There is a question. Can you explain the importance of the personal conception of Godhead?
How can you not? And how foolish we are, ignorant, to deny the personality of Godhead. The Upanishads have a statement which I think is appealing to even the non-theistically minded. Yato va imani bhutani jayante. That from which everything has come, by which it is maintained, and what it will ultimately enter into. Can we agree on that? Yes. Right. So then the question comes, what is the nature of that? Right. Here, we are persons having this discussion. How can we deny the possibility or the prospect of the personal aspect of the original source of everything? As I've told many times when I asked the computer scientist, can you say with absolute certainty that the original source of all aroma, like beautiful aromatic fragrances, can you say with absolute certainty, the original source of all of that has no olfactory capacity, cannot smell? Said, no, with absolute certainty, I cannot. And then you've opened the door for theistic culture. And I can make the same case for each one of the senses. So as we are gifted with seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, smelling, feeling, the origin of all this seeing, hearing, tasting, can see, hear, taste, touch, smell, or not. And if in fact we accept the prospect, the possibility that it can, then that cannot be divorced of personality. It's subjective. All seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, smelling, feeling, all these things are subjective. Right? Without a subjective interpreter, it's irrelevant. So Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Indriyani pranyahur indriyebhya param manaha manasastu parabudhe yobudhe paratastu sa. There's the objective world and the objects of perception, things that are seen, heard, tasted, felt, smelled. So, but then that means the senses are instruments for seeing, hearing, etc. So he's saying the instruments, they're above the objects. They're higher, they're more refined, superior. But the instruments of sense perception, they're the seat of sense perception is the mind. If someone's lost their mind, synonymous with that is they've lost their senses. If you call someone's name and they're absent-minded, they don't hear you. That's very interesting. Right. We could make a video, a recording, and prove to someone that their name was called. They may say, I didn't hear anything. We say, no, we have scientific proof that the sound of your name was made, it entered your ear, what is it? The cochlea, whatever, the little hand, and you know, like went in there. And you say, I don't recall at this time. So that's very interesting. So if you don't care to mind it, nothing is heard. So the mind is the seat of sense experience. As we see also with anesthesia, when you remove consciousness from a particular, like a limb, they can do all kinds of things. They can remove it and you don't feel anything. It's consciousness that feels. And then what is that syndrome you have? The phantom limb syndrome. Once something is removed, still it's as if they feel that it's there. So the mind, mana, manasastu, parabuddhe, and higher, finer, superior to the mind is buddhi, intelligence. The discriminating factor, the mind is less discriminating. The mind reflects whatever comes before it. Cannot but do that. Good, bad, or ugly. But the intelligence says, don't dwell on that. It's unhealthy. It won't be good for you. Get you in trouble. So intelligence is finer. Manasas tu parabhute, yo budhe paratha. So he's taking us in a direction, saying, finer than that, we could throw in ego, but he's saying, finer than that is the soul plane, atma. Bhumirapo analobayu kamano bhutirevata. Ahankara iti ame bina prakritirastada. Krishna tells Arjuna, these eight are inferior energy. Earth, water, fire, air, ether, the mind, intelligence. He's saying it's inferior energy. It's inferior to the soul. Aparayam itastanyam prakriti midive param. There's another prakriti superior to that. That's Atma. Jiva Bhuta Mahabaho Yayadam Daryate Jagat. And that's what's populating this universe, the objective world. All these forms are organic interfaces from the Atma plane to operate, to navigate the objective world. The subjective aspect, Atma, navigating the material world. So Krishna, he's telling us, in summary, that another way of putting this is that identity is located in the subtle plane. What question am I answering?
Can you explain
personality of God? Okay. So, identity is located in the subtle plane. Just like genetics reinforce this idea. To make a so-called duplicate, a clone of someone, you need some genetic material. This isn't Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, where you have a jar with the brain of a criminal and then, a leg from one place and some arms from, sew it all together, add a little lightning and, my God, it's alive! Not like that. Now we know. And in her defense, she was parroting that type of science herself. That was part of her understanding of presenting that story. Because what was it called originally? Prometheus Unbound? So identity lies in this subtle plane. So that means the seeing, hearing, tasting, to all of those sensual activities come from a subtle plane of existence. But we're accustomed to think that the more subtle we go, the less personal things become. That we enter some sort of neutral state. But actually, we can make the case that because the subtle plane means the subjective aspect of existence. That's really where personality lies, where sensuous capacity comes from. And all of this originally from the personality of Godhead, who's known in three aspects, Brahman, Paramatma, Bhagavan. So, take away the personality of Godhead, you're left with Brahma. And the idea, the silly idea that the Brahma can only express itself personally in this world through us. But as we have personality, Our origin has personality. What is that one book called? By Guru, about the origin of everything? The original
source.
Yeah. The original source. So the original source of all personality would have personality or not? It's not unreasonable to think the original source of all personality has personality. Here we see male and female. It's inescapable. Male and female. This whole world is saturated with male and female. All everywhere. The original source. Have any male or female aspect, or just be neuter? Always neuter. Neuter. And this neutered, neutral thing, non-person, generates male and female and so many. Why? Our experience is that male and female generate male and female. And there's always something, well, what about starfish? Forget about starfish. Or seahorses. That's a seahorse. What about, go ride a seahorse. And a race of seahorses. There's always something like that. So that cancels everything else. Consciousness, if we take it that the original source of everything is actually consciousness, not that, as Guru Maharaj said, not that fossil produces consciousness. He called fossilism. That stones reconfigured and evolved to a certain point generate a substance known as consciousness. Or, as he said, can consciousness conceive of stone? Yeah, we can all do that. So, if we take it, go back to the original source as being conscious, then it cannot be devoid of personality. Doesn't exist as disembodied consciousness. It's not some generic substance from which you can inject into persons. We are generally presented a scenario along the lines of a narrative that goes something like this. There are a trillion, trillion stars, and there's this one planet, the Earth, blue planet, the Earth planet, among the trillion, trillion stars, that has life, and by that really we mean, more specifically, conscious living beings. And these conscious living beings, if they get lucky on a good day, they experience a drop of happiness. So in this narrative, anandam, or happiness, is a drop that is sometimes achieved by momentarily by the conscious elite. So in this scenario, the objective world is virtually unlimited. And then in this one speck, you know, molecular almost in a sense, if you factor it, is where the conscious elite are. And that conscious elite on a good day, they experience momentarily a drop of happiness. This is a bleak scenario. Still, everyone's, you know, the happiness is around the corner. I'm making good money. I have a date tonight. I'm going to meet that special someone. The Vedic scenario is just the opposite. It's inverted, and I think more hopeful, saying that Anandam is the ultimate substance. Right. Satchit Anandam, Satcham Shivam Sundaram, Anandam, Anandam Brahmano Vino. Understand, the ultimate reality is not only happy, and but is happiness personified. Personified. There's that word again. Right. So that, and that is not the small thing, it's the all accommodating ultimate substance is Anandam. Krishna Ananda. Krishna Anandam. Right. Ishvara Parama Krishna Satchit Ananda Vigraha. He is the personification of happiness. Anadir Adir Govinda. And his word, Govinda, he's has senses, he's the one who is the ultimate fulfillment of all sensuous prospect, the ultimate beauty to be seen, heard, touched, tasted. All of these senses find their fulfillment. The highest expression is Govinda. So what we're always searching for, sense fulfillment, is realized in Govinda Krishna. Right. Then consciousness is at the basis of all of this. So there's Anandam, and then cognizance, consciousness, and as Guru Maharaj says, an iceberg floating in an ocean of consciousness is the whole objective world. So just the reverse is true. What is Gita say? Urdva mulama dashakam. Everything's upside down and backwards. That's actually good news. At first, when you're saying, oh, how frustrating. No, it's a good thing. So here we think the objective world, that's something you can really, you know, put your foot on and, you know, make something. You can be somebody. Here, because this stuff is solid, it's going to be here for how long? Some scientists, they say, you know, 10 years to the 12th power or something. No, 10 to the 16. But all are in consensus. It all vanishes. Then what? And then your GPS is really thrown off. When the entire objective material world vanishes, you don't get any signal. Your GPS is way off. So how to navigate then? Srila Guru Maharaj says, the world of our faith. Faith is that fine substance. Sometimes the spiritual world is referred to as Shraddha Mayoyam Loka. Right? The world of faith. That's what constitutes the levels of planets in the spiritual world. Even higher or lower, materially speaking, is not entirely correct, right? You know what I'm saying? when you look in space, what's higher and lower, and you know, it's all, these are just relative terms we use to navigate the objective world, basically. So what constitutes higher, lower in the Vaikuntha world? Sometimes Srila Guru Maharaj will say, when he's referencing a Prakriti Lila of Goloka Vrindavan, he'll say, Vaikuntha is the southern hemisphere of the spiritual world, with 2.5 rasas. So what, as I said to Guru Maharaj, when they're just sharing, I said, oh, it occurred to me, a blade of grass in Vaikuntha must be different than a blade of grass in Goloka. And Guru Maharaj said, of course. I thought, I just discovered something profound. And why do we say that? Because of the nature of the Vaikuntha world compared to Goloka Vrindavan. And then within Goloka Vrindavan, if we even hear a simple statement like, Nanda Maharaj and the cowherd men and the gopis, they decided to move their camp to another part of Vrindavan where the grasses were sweeter. Well, if the whole plane is made out of the nature of consciousness and not merely generic consciousness, but chinmoy, Vaikunthya Prithivyari Sakula Chinmoy, chinmoy, spiritually conscious substance enriched with the highest sort of dedicating tendency, then, if just within that example, if this grass is said to be sweeter, then that gives you some indication of the possibilities of gradation in that plane. As Guru Maharaj said, there's gradation in everywhere and in everything, including the spiritual world, up to and including, as he said, Saraswati Thakur, you know, Radha Kunda Tata, the banks of Radha Kunda, the waters of Radha Kunda. There's gradation everywhere and everything. So what to speak of in preliminary positions to that? So why did I say that?
Vaikuntha is the southern hemisphere of spiritual world.
Oh, when the world vanishes.
Yeah.
So, Guru said, we want to live in the world of our faith. Even the, how shall we say, the more educated, literate section, they understand the necessity of dwelling in the subjective plane. That's why there's so much promoting of literature and art and these refined things. As Socrates said, the unexamined life is not one worth living. And these, the intelligentsia, the literati, etc., literati, they can make a case of saying, oh, without these, the beauty of art, of literature, etc., what is a life absent that? And there's something to be said for that. So if such a case can be made, and I believe it can, then what to speak of the spiritual aspect to things, which is really the pure culture of beauty. As Guru Maharaj told for the first book, Reality of the Beautiful. And he was actually reappropriating a statement that he attributed to some French thinker named Martineau. It's been hard to track that down, but just taking it that Guru Maharaj is reliable, we can accept it. But he's saying he liked this, Reality of the Beautiful. As I've said, the Greek basis of the word aesthetic originally means perception. It's about what can be, it's taken to mean, you know, like refined beauty of the highest type. I like that, that reality of the beautiful. It means the aesthetic aspect of life means to see, hear, taste, touch, smell, and feel the personality of Godhead, who is beauty personified. The ultimate aesthetic, sensual, sensuous perception, perceptive experience. Not these foolish biblical impositions that, why does he need so much worship? Why is he demanding? What's wrong with him? What sort of ego is that that he demands to be? But Guru Maharaj did say in Bhagavad Gita, when Krishna says, Man mana bhava mad bhakta majajimam namaskuru. He said, Krishna is shamelessly pleading with Arjuna. And what is he saying? Arjuna, I'm everything. Now he said, that's really an egoistic statement if you're not everything. I get it. If you're not everything, if you're not the ultimate reality, but if you are everything and you are the ultimate reality, it would be unconscionable not to allow others to know that. Unless they were so in love with you that it yogamayic forgetfulness allowed them the divine illusion of just loving you for who you are, not for what you represent or the position that you hold. So for the Jnana Shunya Bhaktas, the Aishwarya aspect, the majestic aspect of divinity is eclipsed, overwhelmed by their love and affection. How beautiful is that? Like in this world, we see the president, the prime minister, the king, his mom, to his mother, it's her boy, her son. Doesn't matter, he's the king, the president, the prime minister, he's my boy. How sweet is that? Her motherly affection eclipses and suppresses the majestic aspect of her son's position. And that brings us back to Yashoda taking Krishna Nam. And one of the last things I heard Srila Gurudev say before he left Navadvip, he was singing some song and he said, Krishna has come home answering the call of Yashoda. And he said, and Nandarani, she's doing arati to the beautiful face of Krishna. She answered, how happy is that? Hare Krishna.